Gentlemen, the case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Equal Employment Opportunity Commission against Federal Labor Relations Authority.
He didn't know what you
I don't find anything in the record to see. He's been across the hall and she's lying there on the floor in the pool. Pieces of tissue on this body and pieces of tissue on this because the police have been on the ball. There's all that tissue to see that it was the same tissue. And it wasn't big enough. I don't think it's wrong, but I've rather heard it from the line. He was in love with him, that's right. Not afraid he was in love with him. I thought somebody was trying to trap him. Ms. Kuhl, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether a government employee union can require a government agency to bargain over, and therefore to make a subject of grievance arbitration, a proposal that would give the union the right to enforce the provisions of Circular A-76. The Court below held that a government employee union can enforce the circular, but this result is anomalous. A-76 is a management directive. It flows from the authority of the President to manage the budget and to manage the executive branch, and it implements the President's economic policies. The circular itself expressly reserves to the President and to his delegates the authority to enforce the circular. But the decision below turns enforcement of the A-76 directive and of the President's management authority, and it turns the interpretation of the directive over to arbitrators with review perhaps only by the Federal Labor Relations Authority, perhaps no judicial review. This result is not only contrary to the expressed language of the circular, but it also interferes with the authority of the President to give directives to his subordinates and to enforce those directives in his own way. It should not be assumed that Congress would have intended this anomalous result and this disruptive result, absent some clear statutory authority. But on the contrary, the statute, in fact, requires no such solution. Let me try to condense here very quickly the statutory provisions that are at issue. All the parties agree that Title VII of the Civil Service Reform Act gives management the right to make determinations with respect to contracting out. And all parties also agree that the only constraint on that management right is that it be — that is the only constraint that's at issue in this case — is that the right to contract out be exercised, quote, in accordance with applicable laws. So that the question for the decision is whether the phrase "in accordance with applicable laws" gives the union a right that no one other than the President has, the right to enforce Circular A-76. The first and most important reason why the "in accordance with applicable laws" language does not give the union the right to enforce the circular is because A-76 is not a law at all.
Ms. Kuhl, suppose that we agree that the circular is not a law for purposes of Section 7106. Does that end the case, or do we still have to determine whether noncompliance with the circular is the subject of a grievance under the Act, notwithstanding whether it's included in a collective bargaining agreement?
That ends the inquiry, in our view, Justice O'Connor.
What ends the inquiry? If we say it's not a law under 7106?
That's correct. If we say it's not a law, that ends the inquiry because —
I thought your opponent said it doesn't because, in any event, it's grievable under the Act.
So that's right. But it's our submission that the language of 7106, which says nothing in this chapter shall interfere with management rights, that applies to not only the negotiability issue, but also to the grievability issue. And the respondents have not presented any reason why Congress would have said nothing in this chapter when, in fact, it meant nothing relating to bargainability or negotiability.
I take it, though, that you take the position that under Section 7117A1,
yes,
the circular is a rule or regulation.
Well, of course, the language there is a bit different. It doesn't say laws. It says laws, rules, or regulations. And we also have some rather specific legislative history there that indicates that Congress was concerned that unions not be able to create rules that would conflict with government-wide policies. It did not want inconsistencies among the agencies. So that there's, number one, a difference in language, and number two, some rather specific legislative history. And in fact, the respondents agree that A76 is a law, rule, or regulation within the meaning of 7117.
Counsel, is the circular reproduced in your brief anywhere?
The circular has been lodged with the court,
Is it very long?
Well, I could show it to you. It's really fairly long.
Yeah, but that isn't the full circular. That's the circular plus the appendices, is it not? I'm a little surprised that neither side has seen fit to produce the circular and any papers that are filed here for the court to consider at the bench.
Well,
I happen to have it, but I just wondered why not.
Well, I apologize if the court does not have those materials available to it. This is the supplement, Your Honor, is correct. The directive itself is in the Federal Register at volume 48, beginning at page 37110.
Well, it's all of 10 pages, and 11 maybe.
It's quite short. My apologies to the court. To continue, then, as to why A76 is not a law within the meaning of the in accordance with applicable laws language, A76 itself makes clear that it is not a law and that its only binding effect flows from the President's authority. The circular states that it does not establish and shall not be construed to create any basis for anyone to challenge agency action or inaction on the grounds that that action or inaction was not in accordance with the circular. The only challenge to agency action that the circular permits is via a very expedited appeal procedure that the circular creates within the agency. And it's important that this procedure is a very rapid one. People who would like to challenge the agency's decision to contract out must file their appeal within 15 days, and the agency within itself must decide within 30 days. And again, there's no further right to review beyond that appeal within the agency. Every court and administrative body other than the court below that has been asked to enforce Circular A76 has respected the limitations that are contained within the language of the circular itself and has refused to create third-party enforcement rights. Two courts of appeal have turned down challenges brought under the Administrative Procedure Act, and the Ninth Circuit has ruled in direct conflict with the decision of the court below. And perhaps most importantly, the Merit System Protection Board, which is the government agency which has authority to enforce employee rights in a non-union context, the MSPB has held that an employee's challenge to a reduction in force brought on the theory that the reduction in force was required by an incorrect decision to contract out, that kind of challenge could not be brought predicated on A76. Thus, in seeking the right to enforce A76, the union is seeking a right that non-union employees indisputably do not have. And it's our view that Congress did not anywhere express an intent to create this kind of disparity.
What effect would the proposal have on management rights other than an effect on grievance and arbitration procedures? Would there be any other effect?
Well, it would have really a very substantive effect. The union suggests that it's proposal is a modest one of trying to enforce A76, but because they want to enforce A76 but don't want to accept the conditions under which the President was willing to issue A76, the union's discretion to make contracting out decisions is very severely impinged. When a grievance...
The unions?
I'm sorry, I misspoke. The agency's authority to make, discretion to make contracting
out decisions. I just wondered
decisions.
What effect it would have other than on grievance and arbitration. If it has one, I haven't heard.
Well, when
a
grievance is filed, Justice O'Connor, the agency is really placed in a difficult dilemma. The agency will.
Well, it is then. You agree with me that it would have no effect other than on grievance and arbitration procedures.
Well, the grievance and arbitration, I think our point is that the grievance and arbitration procedures would affect the substance of contracting out because the agency's decisions will be affected.
Well, the other side takes the position that the Act requires that these matters be subject to grievance and arbitration anyway.
That's correct, but that's because they do not admit that the nothing in this chapter language applies to the grievance proceedings as well as to the negotiability context. But the reason why there's a substantive problem here and not just a procedural problem for the agency is because when a grievance is filed, the agency is faced with quite a dilemma. It either has to decide to proceed with the contract, in which case it risks later having to...
be filed is when there's a proposal to contract out, the union would grieve and say that you're not following the right procedures and you must not do this until you do. Is that it?
That's right. And they to be a little more concrete, they might say, for example, well, you didn't determine personnel costs correctly in making your comparison between in-house costs and costs that would be incurred using an outside
and
contractor.
And if the arbitrator agreed with them, the contracting out would be interfered with, I guess.
It would be, and in fact, it's interesting, the authority even agrees that management discretion would be interfered with under those circumstances. They say at least in some cases. Now, their proposed solution, we think, is not really a solution at all. They say the arbitrators will stay their hands. Don't worry, the arbitrators will not be permitted to second-guess discretionary judgments of the agency. But in fact, the authority doesn't cite any statutory language which would so constrain the authority of the arbitrators. And actually, I draw the conclusion from that the authority doesn't fully believe what it says, that they say that the Management Rights Clause does not apply to the grievance proceedings, but yet they say, well, when arbitrators get into a discretionary area, they'll stay their hands. But they don't propose, the authority does not propose any standards by which arbitrators are to decide when to stay their hands. And moreover, if the arbitrators do not stay their hands in the discretionary areas, there can indeed be review by the Federal Labor Relations Authority, but as I've stated, it is questionable whether — it's an open question as to whether there can be any judicial review beyond that point.
I take it you submit alternative theories by which you could prevail. The theory that 7106 ends the inquiry if the circular is not a law, or the theory that 7117A1 ends the case if we say it's a rule or regulation that's inconsistent.
That's correct, and we have yet another variation on the first theory. If A76 is a law, and of course we don't concede that it is a law, but if it is a law, we say that it is not an applicable law within the meaning of the statute. And the reason that we say that is because we read the in accordance with applicable laws language to give unions the right only to enforce laws that have rights personal, directly personal, to the employees. If you read the phrase in accordance with applicable law more broadly than that, you run into some quite anomalous results, and our respondents do not explain why this result could have been intended by Congress. They wouldn't draw any lines. They would say in accordance with applicable law means that so long as the agency's action is constrained by some law somewhere, and so long as the agency's action has some effect on employees somehow, then there can be review or the unions can enforce that law. But to just give a hypothetical of why that reads in accordance with applicable laws much too broadly, suppose Congress instructs the Forest Service to give priority to fire prevention, and suppose that the Forest Service then decides that it should conduct a reduction in force, and some Forest Service personnel are included in that reduction in force. The authority's construction, the respondent's construction, would seem to allow the union to come in and argue that the reduction in force was not in accordance with applicable law because Congress had indicated that fire prevention was a priority.
Well, in under the union's theory, would that then be decided by an arbitrator?
That's correct. It would be
whether the fire service, Forest Service, was laying off the right people.
That's right. It would be decided by an arbitrator. So that their construction really leads to the conclusion, or would suggest that Congress intended to create very broad private rights of action for union employees. But this Court has held that private rights of action should be inferred only when Congress has intended to create such remedies, and there's no indication of a congressional intent here to create such broad rights of action. To give the unions this kind of broad right of action would create a great disparity, as I've suggested before, between union and non-union employees in terms of the type of statutes that they can seek to enforce. And as I say, there's no evidence Congress intended this. What we can glean from the legislative history is that Congress intended to take traditional personnel decisions that either union or non-union employees could bring under the old executive order regime, and to give unions the ability to take these kinds of rights and raise them through the grievance proceedings. The broad interpretation that the respondents would give to the in accordance with applicable laws language would also interfere with the management rights that are preserved in 7106, subsection A1. To look at the structure of the statute, subsection A1 management rights, which are the right of the agency to control the mission and the budget and the number of employees of the agency, is not constrained by the in accordance with applicable laws phrase. In other words, the agency, insofar as the union is concerned, does not have to act in accordance with applicable laws in setting the mission of the agency. But the respondent's interpretation of in accordance with applicable laws would allow a challenge to be brought under A2 that would reach just the same result that's precluded under subsection A1. This is rather difficult, but let me try and give a hypothetical. Under subsection A2, under the respondent's theory, the union can require that layoffs comply with applicable law. But under their reading, they might be able, for example, to argue that the Forest Service was not complying with Congress's fire prevention priorities when it laid off people in the fire prevention area. But in fact, this kind of challenge would be exactly the sort of challenge that A1 does not permit. It would be a challenge to the mission of the agency, so that while the respondents try to suggest that they have a coherent interpretation of the statute as a whole, in fact, their interpretation does conflict one part of a statute with another, and it also tries to read out certain parts of the statute. For example, it does not give any effect to the language saying nothing in this chapter shall affect. It reads that right out of the statute. To go back again to our submission, particularly with regard to A76 and the consequences that will flow if the arbitral review of A76 decisions is permitted. These decisions, if permitted, that is, if arbitral review is allowed, will inevitably interfere with management's authority to contract out, because every aspect of Circular A76 involves matters of agency discretion. One of the chief reasons why courts have declined under the APA to review compliance with A76 is that it lacks meaningful standards by which to judge an agency's exercise of discretion. And to give just one example, of the kind of discretionary judgments that are involved in an agency's carrying out Circular A76, when the cost comparison is done by the agency, it is premised on a management study that the agency has to conduct to determine the most efficient composition by which the agency could perform the function, so that already you have an element of estimation, an element of exercise of agency judgment in just determining what the in-house cost comparison is to be based on. The circular then goes on to say that in determining personnel costs, one makes a staffing estimate that also is cabined by the tools, judgmental tools that the agency is to use. And as I've mentioned before, even the authority admits that this kind of arbitral review for compliance with A76 will at least sometimes impinge on agency discretion. But again, the solution that they offer is a clearly inadequate one of just the hope that arbitrators will stay their hands when they get into a somehow defined discretionary area. If the Court has no further questions, at this time I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Ms. Peters.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, one of the responsibilities entrusted to the Federal Labor Relations Authority by Congress is the task of determining the negotiability of collective bargaining proposals in the federal sector. This case arose nearly 6 years ago now when AFGE submitted a proposal which provided that petitioner EEOC agree to comply with OMB Circular A76 and other applicable laws and regulations concerning contracting out. The authority found the proposal to be negotiable. Underlying the authority's determination are three basic propositions to which the authority has adhered since the early days of its enabling statute. The first proposition here being that the statute does indeed reserve to management as non-negotiable the substantive exercise in accordance with applicable laws of the management rights enumerated in Section 7106A2. However, a proposal such as the one here that imposes no substantive limitations of its own making, that simply restates management's obligation to comply with applicable legal requirements when exercising those reserved rights, is negotiable. The second proposition here being that the statute in the federal sector defines the scope of the negotiated grievance procedure. Thus, even in the absence of a proposal such as the one here, with or without such a proposal, disputes about the applications of laws, rules, and regulations, such as the circular, affecting conditions of employment, are within the scope of the grievance procedure unless the parties agree through negotiations to exclude such grievances. The final proposition here is likewise rooted in the notion that the statute prescribes the scope and the coverage of the negotiated grievance procedure in the federal sector. Thus, no government-wide rule or regulation, including the circular, even a rule or regulation purporting to address the permissible scope in some fashion of the grievance procedure, may be applied in a manner that is inconsistent with the scope as defined by this Act of Congress. Having stated these propositions, I would also like to note, because I think it is pertinent to an understanding of this case, one proposition in which the authority's decision takes absolutely no root, and that is this authority decision and no other authority decision of which I am aware either is based upon or provides any support for the notion that in the area of management's reserved rights, choices of policy or matters of discretion that management reserves to itself are somehow susceptible to the bargaining process or to the grievance procedure. An examination of the first proposition, that proposals such as the one here are negotiable, demonstrates the faithfulness of the authority in this decision to the text of the statute and to its own decisional precedent. The statute does reserve to management in Section 7106A2, along with other rights, the non-negotiable substantive authority to make determinations with respect to contracting out. The authority in its decisional precedent has recognized, respected, and effectuated that reservation of authority to management. But this authority reserved to management is not unfettered. By the literal terms of the statute, that authority is subject, first of all, to the negotiation of procedures under Section 7106B2 and appropriate arrangements under Section 7106B3. Furthermore, the statute expressly provides that management's contracting out authority, as well as the other enumerated reserved rights, must be exercised in accordance with applicable laws. Thus, a bargaining proposal like this one is not rendered non-negotiable simply because it mentions a reserved right. Indeed, in a long line of decisional precedent, the authority has consistently found to be negotiable proposals like the one in this case, proposals that impose no substantive criteria of their own making, but instead simply restate management's obligation to act in accordance with applicable laws.
It is a little difficult to conceive of a policy circular like this as being a law, though, isn't it?
Well, I would note that it was published for notice and comment in the Federal Register, and that petitioner would have it be a rule or regulation within the meaning of Section 7117.
But not necessarily a law. I think it is somewhat conceptually difficult to think of this circular as being a law.
Well, in terms of Section 7106, I think that a natural meaning given to that term and the term that the authority has given to the term in accordance with applicable laws means applicable legal requirements. And certainly in any of the legal criteria that apply to the rights there, whether it be contracting out or discipline or promotions or work assignments, any of the underlying laws, rules, or regulations could involve expressions of executive or congressional policy. Even our own statute and most congressional enactments have some policy root.
Well, what if the director of OMB, instead of issuing a circular, had simply called in the administrative officers of all the agencies and departments and said, look, I'm going to tell you now how we're going to handle contracting out. And he told them, maybe in 15 minutes or half an hour, what's the substance of this circular? And they took notes and then went back and said, all right, here's how we're told to handle contracting out. Now, is that an applicable law under the statute?
In that situation, it may not be. Whatever checks or balances or review there would be of such a procedure probably wouldn't come from collective bargaining or the arbitration process. It might come from a congressional oversight committee or the public at large, but not this process.
Well, what if a third party interested in contracting out were to try to litigate the question of whether EEOC had properly complied with the OMB directive? Do you think it could bring a lawsuit saying, look, you didn't follow the OMB requirements here?
They may have access to the Comptroller General.
Do you think they could? That wouldn't be a lawsuit. Do you think they could bring a lawsuit?
Well, I do not know. The precedent that exists to this time seems to me either to be based upon a pre-1979 version of the circular, that is, during that period, or based upon precedent developed in that period. One of the claims court's decisions cited by AFGE in its brief suggests at 4 Claims Court, page 198, and it's the International Graphics Division case, that the post-1979 case, Local 2855 versus Brown, that relied upon previous cases, relied upon the version of the circular in 1967 that said no specific standards or guidelines are set present for determining whether cost savings are justify going contracting rather than staying in-house. But the claims court suggests that the vitality of this aspect of that case, which I believe is an 11th Circuit case, was diminished by the replacement in 1979 of that portion of the circular with the specific and detailed, and this is the language of the claims court, cost comparison handbook. So what would happen now in litigation, I am not sure, but it would appear that disappointed bidders or offerers could go to the Comptroller General under certain circumstances. They have entertained review of what they call the mandatory procedures set forth in the cost comparison handbook. And it seems to me that looking at the Comptroller General cases cited by AFGE in its brief, that when a disappointed bidder or offerer goes there, that the Comptroller General conducts the same sort of analysis that occurs under arbitration of applicable laws in our program.
Well, Ms. Peters, yes. Suppose we disagree with you and think the circular isn't a law under the terminology of Section 7106. Does that end the case?
Well, I'm not sure conceptually how it would not be an applicable law, first of all, particularly in view of the fact, for example, that the OMB itself...
So just suppose that we disagree with you and think it's not. Does that end the case?
In my view and in the authority's view, the scope of the grievance procedure is defined by the statutory definition of grievance. And the statutory definition of grievance talks about matters, first of all, relating to the employment of an employee, and secondly, about the misapplication of laws, rules, or regulations affecting conditions of employment. So even if it weren't a law, perhaps a question whether it's a government-wide rule or regulation, which even petitioner would agree it is under Section 7117 would be pertinent, there are perhaps other applicable laws.
Well, how would it be pertinent?
Pardon?
You just said that would be pertinent. What would be — why would it be pertinent?
If it were a rule or a regulation, even if it could not be considered a law, and if it contains some mandatory criteria.
The authority's position is that any applicable rule or regulation is grievable.
That relates — that affects conditions of employment. Of course —
Is that because of the definition of a grievance in the statute?
That is correct.
And so it doesn't make any difference whether in the collective bargaining agreement it says that management will abide by all rules and regulations?
That is correct. Both the AFGE and NTEU indicated in their briefs to this court.
So grievance, under this scheme, grievances are not limited to construing and applying the collective bargaining agreement. Is that it?
That is correct, under our statutory scheme. The language of the statute.
That's in a statutory definition.
Yes, it is.
Does the agency have authority to issue regulations to implement the
statute? Yes, we do. We have both formal and rulemaking, formal and informal rulemaking authority, as this court has noted in BATF.
So the, what do you call the statute? The Federal Labor Relations Law?
It's called the Federal Service Labor Management Relations Statute in our parliament.
And you feel, and is it clear that the agency is entrusted with the enforcement of that statute?
Of our statute? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. We are an independent body set up, but the provisions 5 U.S.C. 7101 through 7135 are...
And you construe the language of the statute to apply to a situation like this, whether this is a law or whether it isn't, for another purpose. You would say that it nevertheless is enough of a government right regulation to be grievable.
Well, petitioner...
Within the meaning of the statute.
Petitioner has found it to be a government-wide rule or regulation within the meaning of Section 7117 of the statute. And, in fact, the Office of Management and Budget extended national consultation rights to unions under Section 7117(d)(1) of the statute, which national consultation rights are extended.
So why should we debate some abstract thing like whether this presidential directive is a, quote, law, unquote, or not? Why don't we just say, ask whether it's grievable anyway?
Well, that would, I think, be to be the pertinent point. This is, of course, a negotiability proceeding. All the authority decided here is whether this proposal is negotiable. And in response to the
It needn't be negotiable to be grievable.
That is correct. But the authority's theory that it is negotiable is because it places no substantive limitations of its own making upon management's rights. And the issue of grievability arose when the authority stated in its decision that if EEOC, the petitioner, were interpreting this as somehow by placing this in the contract.
Well, to make it negotiable, don't you have to say that it's a law? Don't you have to win on that issue?
Well, in our view, it is. In our view, the natural meaning of the phrase in accordance with applicable laws means applicable legal requirements. Many of those requirements may be discretionary, and they would not be susceptible to the grievance procedure. In the area of management rights, essentially, management holds all the cards. It first of all determines the underlying policy. For example, in the reduction in force area or the layoff area, which is a reserved management right, it determines, for example, whether reductions in force are preferable to furloughs. And it also determines whether reductions in force should be based upon seniority or performance or some combination thereof. Having established policies, it also chooses the criteria by itself without grieving or bargaining upon which it exercises such rights and effectuates such policies. To the extent that it chooses discretionary criteria for itself, those would not be susceptible to the grievance procedure. And this is true whether it is contracting out or layoff or discipline or any of the reserved management rights. But to the extent that management chooses for itself mandatory criteria, then against which compliance can be measured, and it would appear that the Comptroller General, at least in this area, has been able to find some mandatory criteria, although there are also some discretionary ones, against which compliance can be measured, that would be susceptible to the grievance procedure to the extent that it affects conditions of employment.
Ms. Peters, may I ask you a question
Yes.
at this point? That's true whether or not this provision is included in the contract under your submission.
That is correct.
Under your submission, would the inclusion of this provision in the contract make anything subject to the grievance procedure that would not already be subject to the grievance procedure?
The inclusion of this in the contract would make nothing subject to the grievance procedure which is not already.
And why is it so important to the union then?
Both NTU and the amicus and AFGE, our joint respondent here, indicated in their briefs to this court that it is simply a common practice in the federal sector where so many things are subject to law.
Is it worth litigating about? I'm just wondering.
It is what we are litigating about.
I know. Is it worth all the time? If it really doesn't make any difference just because it's customary to do it, is that really a sufficient reason to?
For putting it in the contract?
Yeah, if you have the same rights without it. I really have been puzzled.
Or bring him to bargain if it isn't important.
Well, of course, simply by it is in line with long-established precedent to find this negotiable. This is not the first time that the authority has found an in accordance with applicable laws provision to be negotiable.
Well,
and in terms of ordering them to bargain, the petitioner can say that it does not want such a provision in the contract. We are not telling them to agree to the provision. We are simply telling them to bargain.
At least it would make the contract shorter if you left the provision out.
Yes.
But I've got your point in some of these colloquies.
Yes.
Is it your position that the phrase in the statute, in accordance with applicable law, means that they conduct an arbitration to decide what that means? What is applicable law?
Arbitration only would view mandatory criteria that somehow affect conditions of employment. That is the extent to which arbitration is involved in an area such as this or in any other of the areas reserved to management, such as layoff or promotion, for example.
Well, I'm still not sure I have your answer. Who decides
yes.
whether something is in accordance with applicable law?
Well, the arbitrator would look at something and see...
The arbitrator and not the agency. Not the statutory agent that's engaging in the contracting out.
The statutory agent would be an employing agency, and it would have one view, perhaps, of the applicable law. The arbitrator, as with the other management rights...
But you're saying that must be arbitrated.
Under the statute, the express terms of the statute, the grievance procedure extends to misapplications or misinterpretations or violations of laws, rules, or regulations, and that would include laws, government-wide rules or regulations, or agency
circular.
Regulations. Yes,
and
in our view, yes.
Is that applicable law includes the circular.
That is correct. Yes.
Ms. Peters?
Yes.
Did the agency interpret the proposal with respect to circular A-76 to mean that if it were agreed to or otherwise came into effect, that the provisions of Circular A-76 as it then stood would bind EEOC as to the employees, even though the OMB were to change the circular?
I don't know if that's what the petitioner here had in mind. Authority precedent makes clear that it doesn't permit that. For example, in the lead case in the contracting out area where the authority protected the substantive rights of management to choose its own criteria and make its own policy, in that case, NFFE Local 1167, the proposal simply was to put portions of the circular as it existed into the contract, and the authority found that non-negotiable because it would bind them to that even if the circular changed. But a proposal such as this, in the authority's view, simply in accordance with applicable laws, does not, because management retains the right and there are no specific provisions of the circular or other applicable laws in the contract, and so that management can change those during the life of the contract, and those will be the applicable provisions in any grievance or arbitration or in any other way that they affect employees.
Ms. Peters.
Yes.
Why couldn't this have been settled within the administrative section of government?
Well, we are in an independent agency, and we are an adjudicatory agency.
Did nobody who could have settled it?
Well, we are here as respondents, Justice Marshall, and this case began when we made an adjudication of a negotiability dispute. The petitioner petitioned for review in the D.C.
This
Circuit.
This is a case of the United States versus the United States.
Perhaps, but we are set up to be an independent agency to resolve labor disputes within the federal government. And in the words of Judge Starr of the D.C. Circuit, we are set up to favor neither management nor labor, and therefore we are neutral, we are independent, and our adjudicatory decisions are reviewed.
For example, the government pays for all of these expenses, the briefs and everything, on
that is
both
correct.
Sides.
That is correct.
On both sides.
That is correct. Well, the statute does provide precisely for judicial review in the courts of appeals under much the same scheme as though decisions of the NLRB are subject to judicial review in the courts of appeals.
May I ask you the other side of the question I asked a little bit ago?
Certainly.
Assume for just Burst's argument that apart from the agreement that the questions of this kind would not be grievable. Would the inclusion of this clause make them grievable if they otherwise were not grievable?
Well, the statute also provides in its definition of grievance that grievances extend to disputes over collective provisions in the collective bargaining agreement. So assuming for the sake of argument that this would make them grievable, putting them in the contract would. But it continues to be our position.
Your position, it doesn't make any difference. But your opponent's position, of course, is that it's critical then.
That is correct. Okay.
put it in the contract, wouldn't it? I mean, if they wanted, if somebody raised an issue about what it meant.
It is within the statutory definition of grievance. It expressly refers to such disputes as being...
About the meaning of the contract.
Yes, collective bargaining
provisions.
Or about
the enforcement of it, yeah.
The exact provision is that the effect or interpretation or a claim of breach of a collective bargaining agreement comes within the statutory definition of grievance.
Doesn't it follow that if some disputes under the meaning of the circular A76 are now grievable and some are not, just as in the, because there are always different kinds of disputes, putting this provision in the contract would make everything grievable then, and would expand the wouldn't it necessarily expand the subjects that would be grievable?
Respectfully, no, Justice Stevens. This is no different from any of the other government-wide rules or regulations that govern the other reserved rights of management. All of them, I'm sure, contain some discretionary aspects. Some of them contain some mandatory criteria that affect conditions of employment. It is the authority's long-established precedent in the way that it treats review of arbitration awards and in the way that it treats other portions of its adjudicatory responsibilities that only the mandatory criteria become subject to the grievance procedure and to the extent that they affect conditions of employment. Now,
I'm a little troubled by that statement because I suppose it gets back to what the Chief Justice was asking. You have to go through grievance and arbitration to determine whether the agency discretion will be allowed or not. It's going through the process to which the government objects, I guess.
Well, if the government
it's
objects...
It's your position that is not a burden. Let them go through the process, and at the end of the line, the arbitrator will say, well, that's subject to agency discretion, so the agency wins.
It certainly is not a burden that is outside the contemplation of Congress, if it is a burden at all, because Congress made such matters subject to the grievance procedure. Petitioner and other employing agencies do have one avenue. The exceptions to the grievance procedure as defined by statute are either the five subjects enumerated in the statute, there are five subject areas, or they are matters that the parties themselves agree to exclude from the grievance procedure through negotiations. And so, therefore, petitioner can propose during collective bargaining negotiations that contracting out matters or any other matters that it does not want to have subject to the grievance procedure be excluded from the broad scope of the grievance procedure. But absent such negotiations and agreement between the parties, the statutory definition is quite explicit and quite expressed in its breadth and in terms of what it covers. Now, despite the fact that contracting out is not one of the five subjects expressly excluded by Congress, the petitioner has contended throughout this litigation that matters concerning contracting out are not grievable. In essence, petitioner has argued that the statute's designation of a subject as a management right also operates to preclude the subject from the scope of the grievance procedure. But petitioner now acknowledges to this court that grievances over discipline and promotions are permissible, even though discipline and promotions are reserved management rights. But petitioner's reliance on the phrase in Section 7106, nothing in this chapter shall affect, as having that effect of removing it from the grievance procedure is unavailing. First of all, if they were correct about that language, it would mean that even discipline and promotions were not grievable, and they have acknowledged that those subjects are grievable. Furthermore, relying on that phrase in isolation just doesn't take into account the in accordance with applicable laws language or the fact that the statute expressly says that it is subject to procedures and appropriate arrangements bargaining. And, of course, the legislative history certainly indicates that that section of the statute is meant only to prohibit bargaining in certain respects, and it does not treat the grievability of matters. Petitioner now also makes the argument to this court that even if it were somehow coming within the grievance procedure, it nevertheless should be excluded because contracting out determinations bear only indirectly on the employment relationship. But, of course, there are any number of indications of the direct effect of contracting out matters on bargaining unit and employees, and that contracting out affects or is a condition of employment. Among these indications are the very terms of the circular, which since 1979 has recognized the stake that employees and their bargaining representatives have in contracting out by providing them access to the circular's appeals procedure for challenging cost comparisons. The circular, I would note, describes its appeals procedure as a mechanism, quote, intended to protect the rights of all directly affected parties, unquote. Moreover, the circular provides that employees should be informed about the undertaking and the progress of cost studies, and agency regulations, which also could involve grievable matters to the extent that they impose mandatory criteria. Agency regulations such as the Air Force and Army regulations referenced in AFGE's brief have specific provisions about employee and union involvement in aspects of the cost study. And the circular itself also addresses arrangements for employees who are adversely affected by the conversion to contract performance of services. And as I have noted before, the Office of Management and Budget extended national consultation rights over the circular to federal sector unions. And those are extended with regard to laws, rules, or regulations, or, excuse me, government-wide regulations affecting any substantive change in any condition of employment. And furthermore, the notion that Congress intended to exclude contracting out matters from the scope of the grievance procedure doesn't find any support in the legislative history or the language. And to the extent that private sector precedent provides an appropriate analogy for our program, that law strongly supports the status of contracting out as a condition of employment and of its susceptibility to the grievance procedure. But this does not mean, of course, to say that anything, no matter how attenuated its relationship or effect on employment, would be subject to the grievance procedure, but that matters such as this are. Disputes involving contracting out determinations to the extent that they affect — excuse me. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Ms. Gould?
I'd just like to make one point briefly, if I may. Of course, it is our submission that 7106 states that or applies not only to negotiability but also to the grievance procedure, so that the reason why we're debating here over whether A76 is a law or not is because 7106 constrains not only negotiability but also arbitrability.
Don't you have to convince us that the agency's interpretation of the relevant statute is just contrary to the statute?
Well, I'm glad
and,
you asked.
And there's just not any room for their position?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because it does raise the question of agency deference. And number one, we do say that it is that their construction is just simply contrary to the statute, and that it's something that this court, even giving deference, can't accept.
And you have to convince us of that, don't you?
Well, but also the agency has not been consistent in its interpretation, and
I think a lot of agencies aren't, and we still defer.
Well, but it is. It is on this very subject.
And your office frequently asks us to.
Well, it is unusual for us to be arguing against agency deference
Isn't
here.
Isn't there something of a little bit of reciprocal deference involved here, too?
Well,
you have two agencies.
Well, and indeed, as to the interpretation of A76, it should be the interpretation of the Office of Management and Budget that should prevail. But on the issue of whether 7106 applies to grievances, the authority's own decisions have held, and I might just cite AFGE Local 1968 and Department of Transportation in 1981 decision. That decision and others, the PATCO decision, have held that whenever a proposal for negotiation creates a possibility, even a possibility, that an arbitrator will second-guess the agency's management discretion, the result should be that there should be no negotiation over that proposal as well as ultimately no grievances may be brought on the proposal. For those reasons, we ask that the court reverse the decision of the judgment below.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.
Have we got three agencies to defend?